Well, what's Universal Time? Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson has announced a review of Iran policy, accusing Tehran of alarming ongoing provocations that export terror and violence, destabilizing more than one country at a time. Tillerson called Iran the world's leading sponsor of terror, responsible for conflicts in Yemen, Syria, Iraq, and Lebanon, and warning it's taking a path like that of North Korea.
The United States is keen to avoid a second piece of evidence that strategic patience is a failed approach. A comprehensive Iran policy requires that we address all of the threats posed by Iran, and it is clear there are many.
Tillerson said the 2015 nuclear deal with Tehran has ignored the other serious threats the country poses. University of Denver International Affairs Professor Jonathan Edelman said the review was long overdue and Iran has repeatedly broken the nuclear deal.
They're breaking something that's more important than the agreement, which is primarily about nuclear capability. They are out to literally reconquer a significant portion of the Middle East. And given their deep hostility to the United States, to democracy, to capitalism, and so forth, this has helped lead to the situation that we're now facing.
President Donald Trump ordered the review of Iran policy to evaluate whether suspension of sanctions, part of the nuclear deal with Iran, was vital to the national security interests of the United States. The UN Wednesday said it found more mass graves in the Democratic Republic of Congo's central Kasai region. Between April 5 and 7, they discovered 17 graves in an area plagued by violence between tribal militia and security forces. Fighting erupted last August after troops killed tribal chief Jean-Pierre Mpandi, who had launched an uprising against President Joseph Kabila. The UN rights chief said the latest discovery raises the number of mass graves discovered to 40. This is VOA News. U.S. Defense Secretary Jim Mattis, speaking in Saudi Arabia Wednesday, said Iran's destabilizing influence in the Middle East must be overcome.
From the militia they maintain, Lebanese Hezbollah, that they support in Lebanon, that militia is also contributing thousands of fighters. And, of course, Iran's got its own military inside Syria, continuing to hold Assad in power. Everywhere you look, if there's trouble in the region, you find Iran.
He said ending that influence is key to ending the conflict in Yemen. Thousands of civilians and rebel fighters have left the Syrian town of Zabadani, part of a reciprocal evacuation agreement between the government in Damascus and the opposition to end seizures of four towns, two held by the government and two by rebels. Trinity College analyst David Lesh said it's part of the government's strategy to retake territory in the six-year conflict by any means possible.
Because they don't have the manpower or resource base to militarily take, town by town, city by city. So they've had to use all sorts of tactics from preventing food supplies from entering towns, from withholding humanitarian aid to bludgeoning the population with remote bombing from the air and from artillery.
That, he said, forces occupants to submit to survive. Meanwhile, Israeli defense officials say Syria still possesses up to 3 tons of chemical weapons. At the same time, the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons said Wednesday that sarin gas or another banned toxin was used in the April 4 attack on an Idlib province town that killed nearly 90 people and is being blamed on Damascus. Egyptian security forces said they tracked down and killed a gunman suspected of being part of an attack near a Christian monastery in the southern Sinai Tuesday that left one policeman dead and several others wounded. Islamic State claimed responsibility. The attack occurred on a police checkpoint near the Christian monastery. The attack came ahead of a scheduled visit by Pope Francis to Egypt nearly 2 weeks after two suicide bombers killed more than 40 worshippers at two Coptic Christian churches. Two of Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe's political rivals said Wednesday they're forging an alliance to deny to the 93-year-old leader another term in office. Morgan Tsvangirai leads the MDC Tea Party.
I am pleased to inform the nation that today we have signed a memorandum of understanding with Dr. Joyce Mujuru of the National People's Party to establish a pre-election alliance en route to the establishment of a coalition government.
Joyce Mujuru served as Mr. Mugabe's vice president until she was deposed in 2014. Mr. Mugabe has led the country since 1980. Nigerian President Buhari Wednesday ordered an investigation into allegations of corruption targeting a senior intelligence official over the use of funds intended for humanitarian aid. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Thursday, April 20th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The United Nations and the African Union sign enhanced cooperation agreement.
We share the vision that peace and security, inclusive and sustainable development, and human rights and good governance are dimensions that need to be seen together and that require a common vision.
That's UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres. Nigeria's President Muhammadu Buhari launches an inquiry into the recent discovery of large quantities of cash in an apartment building. Cameroon denies forcibly repatriating Nigerian refugees, and Uganda's army declares victory over the Lord's Resistance Army rebels.
I think most importantly, the environmental conditions that allowed the group to really emerge in the first place, they still exist. And so while the group is deeply degraded, it may have an opportunity for a resurgence.
Pamela Faber is the author of a new report, Sources of Resilience in the LRA. Zimbabwe's main opposition MDC announces plans to merge with former Vice President Joyce Mujuru's party. And we'll examine mining in South Africa and its poisonous legacy. Those stories plus our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The United Nations and the African Union on Wednesday took a step toward increasing cooperation and coordination between their organizations with the signing of a framework for enhanced partnership in peace and security. VOA's Margaret Bashir has more from the United Nations.
The framework agreement is intended to boost cooperation in preventing and responding to conflict in Africa. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres told reporters at a joint news conference with African Union Commission Chairperson Moussa Faki Mahamat that it would enhance cooperation at all levels.
We share the vision that peace and security, inclusive and sustainable development, and human rights and good governance are dimensions that need to be seen together and that require a common vision and an enhanced cooperation between our two organizations.
In addition to peace and security issues, the framework also expands cooperation on electoral matters, good governance, mediation, protecting human rights, and preventing and responding to humanitarian crises. Mahamat, who was elected African Union chairperson in January, welcomed the agreement, which comes at a time when the continent is coping with several armed conflicts, terrorism, increased migration and displacement, and the risk of famine in three countries. At the same time, leaders are working to implement a sustainable development agenda and create jobs for an exploding youth population.
Mais le continent africain.
Mahamat said there is extraordinary potential on the African continent. It has significant resources, the majority of its population is young, and they are 60% of the estimated population of 1.2 billion people. He welcomed the new cooperation between the two organizations and said it would help them align their individual agendas better to produce results. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
The Ugandan military began withdrawing Wednesday from Central African Republic, saying it has defeated the Lord's Resistance Army rebels. The LRA has been fighting the Ugandan government since the late 1980s, but Reuters news agency quoted the Ugandan People's Defense Forces as saying the LRA has lost its means of waging war and no longer poses a significant threat. Pamela Faber is with the Washington-based CNA Corporation and author of a new report, Sources of Resilience in the LRA. She says while the LRA has been degraded significantly, most of the environmental conditions that it has thrived in over the years still exist and may create an opportunity for the group's resurgence.
I think the research shows that the LRA is, in fact, a deeply degraded group. It is a group that really is a vestige of what it once was when it was able to kill over 100,000 people. That said, the group still exists, Kony is still alive, and they are still abducting. I think most importantly, the environmental conditions that allowed the group to really emerge in the first place, they still exist in many of the places that the LRA currently functions, including Northeast DRC, Central African Republic, etc. And so while the group is deeply degraded, it may have an opportunity for a resurgence based on the environmental conditions.
Many armies have been looking for the LRA, particularly Joseph Kony, including even the U.S. Africa Command. But still, as you mentioned, they have been resilient. So what do you think has contributed to the resiliency of the LRA?
Well, there are two major things that I believe have contributed to the resiliency of the LRA on the tactical level. The first is their defensive maneuvering. They've managed to, since fleeing Uganda, they've traveled thousands of kilometers across several countries. They've broken up into small, mobile bands that hide in very sparsely populated border zones. But they've also decreased their abductions, and they've developed a new relationship with civilians on the ground. For instance, they've become increasingly involved in networks of criminality and smuggling, and so they really have adapted to their new circumstances. I think the LRA finds itself in a position where it is a very destructive but small force at this point within Central Africa amongst a very complicated and chaotic geopolitical arrangement where you have rivalry and often perhaps poor relations between some countries in the region, historically Sudan, South Sudan, Uganda, etc. And you also have ongoing conflicts in the region, civil conflicts in the Central African Republic, in the northeast of the DRC, in South Sudan, of course. And so the LRA is able to maneuver amongst and between these conflicts in a way that a larger group may not really be able to, and also in a way that allows it to find relationships for support and safe haven.
Do you think, Pamela, that anyone can claim victory over the LRA, short of capturing, say, Joseph Kony, because I think he embodies this organization?
I think Joseph Kony certainly embodies the LRA. I also think that Joseph Kony is, in some ways, a deeply disabled individual now. There is evidence that he is not necessarily in communication with various LRA splinter groups that are on the ground, and they may be functioning independently of one another. That said, the fact that Joseph Kony is still alive does serve as a strong symbol for the LRA, and it can continue to be a rallying call for LRA combatants.
Pamela Faber is with the Washington-based CNA Corporation. She is the author of a new report, Sources of Resilience in the LRA. She was speaking with me from Washington, D.C. Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari has set up a committee led by Vice President Yemi Osinbajo to investigate the recent discovery of large quantities of cash at an apartment in the commercial capital, Lagos. Officials of the Economic and Financial Crimes Commission, the EFCC, discover over $43 million in the Lagos apartment. The president also suspended the director general of the National Intelligence Agencies pending the outcome of the inquiry. This after the National Intelligence Agency and the Rivers State local government both claimed ownership of the cash. Femi Adesina, spokesperson for President Buhari, tells VOA's Peter Clotty that the vice president and his team have 2 weeks to present their findings to the president.
The committee has just been set up to be headed by the vice president, and other two members of the committee are the National Security Advisor and the Attorney General of the Federation. So they are going to look into the circumstances of the two issues at stake.
Some Nigerians have said the EFCC in the past few weeks have uncovered cash in specific areas in the country that also needs investigation. Will this come under Vice President Osinbajo's investigation as the president has directed?
No, not at all. This one is specifically on the one that involves the National Intelligence Agency.
Is this the reason why the head of the National Intelligence Agency has been suspended by the president?
That would just exactly be it, because there are some gray areas in the entire saga. So to get to the bottom of the matter, there has to be an unfettered investigation. And that is why he needs to step aside for a while so that the investigation can be conducted without let or hindrance.
Femi, some people have suggested that the government is taking credit for the recent findings, discoveries of monies, and that the whistleblowing seem to be working for the EFCC and, for that matter, the president's agenda. Your reaction to that?
Yes, the president has fighting corruption as one of the major planks of his campaign and major policy. So anything that will make him succeed in that campaign, he will do. And that is one of the reasons why the whistleblower's policy.
So the president supports the possible whistleblowing act in the lawmaking bodies, so he would sign it into law?
The whistleblower's policy passed through the Federal Executive Council. So it got the endorsement of government. I don't think it's something that needs a law, but it has been endorsed as a policy.
So what should Nigerians expect in this fight against corruption? Because on social media, everybody is talking about these large cash discoveries in several parts of the country.
It is. We saw the president pin anti-corruption as one of the major planks of his administration. He knew that corruption was a problem for Nigeria. So in this fight, there will be no retreat, no surrender. He will fight it to the last.
Some supporters of the president are saying that his choice of the EFCC chairman, Mr. Magu, seemed to be thwarted by some people in the lawmaking body. Does Mr. Magu have the support of President Buhari in the fight against corruption? And will he again submit his name for consideration by the Senate?
The vice president already spoke about that. And what the vice president has said must be taken as the authentic position of government. And what he said was that no law compels the executive to actually forward the name of Mr. Magu to the Senate. I think there is Section 171 of the Constitution which empowers the president to appoint anybody he wants to appoint. We know that the EFCC Act states that the chairman must be confirmed by the Senate, but no act supersedes the Constitution. In fact, the Constitution is superior to any act.
Femi Adesina is the spokesman for Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari. He spoke with viewers Peter Clotte from the capital, Abuja. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, April 20th. Daybreak Africa time is 17:30 past the hour. In northern Cameroon, the military says some 7,000 Nigerian refugees have gone back to their towns and villages in the past month as part of a voluntary repatriation program. However, Cameroon continues to face accusations that refugees have also been forcibly removed. Moki Edwin Kinzeka has the story from Fotokol in northern Cameroon.
This two-day-old baby boy cries as his parents take seats in a Cameroonian military truck in the border town of Fotokol. Soon, they will be heading home to the Nigerian village of Gamborungala. Many of these refugees fled their homes in that area 2 years ago as Boko Haram attacked villages, looting, kidnapping and killing the locals. 23-year-old returnee Fadi Naji says when she arrived in Cameroon, she did not dream of returning home one day because all of her 5 sisters and brothers had been killed. She says she is returning now with the hope of starting a new life. Ismaila Ali, a Cameroon military official escorting the refugees, says most of the repatriated refugees are originally from the villages of Banki, Golomba, Gamboru, as well as Bama Town. He says since last month, Cameroon has repatriated 6,695 refugees up to the Nigerian border town of Mobi in Adamawa State. He says the refugees are fed, given drinkable water, and treated if they fall ill during the journey. Over the past 2 years, an offensive by Nigerian, Cameroonian, and other regional troops has dislodged Boko Haram from most of the territory it controls in northeast Nigeria. The Islamist radical group continues to carry out periodic suicide bombings. The UN Refugee Agency says it conducted a survey in September of last year in Minawao, where about 80,000 Nigerian refugees lived at the time. That survey indicated that 71% of the refugees wanted to return home when the security situation allowed. In May, the governments of Cameroon and Nigeria, together with UNHCR, signed a voluntary repatriation agreement. Cameroon's Minister of Territorial Administration and Decentralization, René Emmanuel Sadi, says Cameroon is respecting the terms.
Pour le Cameroun, il s'agira de mettre en place.
He says Cameroon has to assure that the refugees' return is safe while their dignity is respected. He says there is no question of forcing them, but rather making sure that the families go back when peace and security has returned to their localities. However, on Wednesday, Doctors Without Borders issued a statement saying MSF has witnessed Cameroonian forces forcibly returning Nigerian refugees since 2016, even as fresh violence in Borno State continues to create more displacement. Doctors Without Borders said these returning refugees have come home to border communities where food and other resources are already dangerously overstretched and access for aid organizations is extremely limited. Cameroon's government spokesman rejected the accusations of forced repatriations, telling VOA they are ungrounded. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News in Fotokol, Cameroon.
Zimbabwe's main opposition movement for democratic change, MDC, led by former Prime Minister Morgan Tsvangirai, has announced it will merge with former Vice President Joyce Mujuru's National People's Party. Tsvangirai said Wednesday that the merger is just the beginning of an overall effort to form a broader coalition to stop 93-year-old Robert Mugabe from seeking another term in office. Human rights activist Clement Moyo says while the idea of a coalition is a good thing, many Zimbabweans may still be skeptical of a merger with Ms. Mujuru because of her past.
Doing a coalition is quite a good thing, although I haven't got much faith on Joyce Mujuru. It is good because you are trying to put voters together so that you don't spread them, so that you may still have a chance of winning an election if you compete together as one political party, rather than splitting votes.
Now, what does Joyce Mujuru bring to the coalition? Let's say it becomes a reality.
Support that she booked out of ZANU-PF. She has a lot of support. She did campaign against Robert Mugabe in 2008. That's the reason why Tsvangirai won those elections by a big margin, although in the announcement of the election, the margin was torn down. But to say that the majority of the Zimbabweans who are in the opposition are going to support the coalition, I think that would be a big ask. Because they still don't have faith in Joyce Mujuru. There's an allegation that she was involved in a lot of corrupt activity. So that alone may cause voter apathy. People may not go to vote.
The elections are not until 2018. What is the climate in Zimbabwe? Do you think elections can be held free and fair, especially with President Robert Mugabe saying that he is going to run again?
I don't think the elections will be run in a fair and fair manner because the voters' role itself at the moment is not there. The Election Commission has no budget to put up a voters' roll that can be a free and fair election. They are talking about bringing in the BVR, the biometrical voting system. They have not started that yet. You know, registering voters using that particular system needs a lot of time. There is a lot of area to cover, and there's a lot of people that they have to register. They should have started. Even now, they don't have even the money. Kids have not been bought. And my understanding is money is going to come from somewhere where the government should have put that in their budget if they were serious enough. So I don't think there will be a fair and free election at all.
Do you think a coalition of the MDC and Joyce Mujuru's party alone can do it, or do they need more political parties to join them?
Yes, political parties may join them. But you see, it's not only the political parties that they should be looking at now, or the people that are going to vote. They should be looking at when they win the election, do they have enough political environmental climate that is conducive to the investors. At the moment, the economy of Zimbabwe is very, very bad. They need trust out there. they need better international relations. And that can only come up if they bring in people like Tendai Biti into the fold.
Tendai Biti, meaning the former finance minister?
Yes, the former finance minister. The international community sort of trusts in the manner he handled finances during his time. It's a better climatical environment for international investment.
You mentioned the economy of Zimbabwe that should go against President Mugabe. He spoke this week during the Independence Day celebration. What did you make of his speech and the economy?
That's rhetoric. It's useless. There seems to be nobody in charge in Zimbabwe at the moment. Nobody is doing anything. They are keeping in ministers that have badly performed, hardly performed at all, and they have not bettered the economy. And so that simple talk at a rally, they talk at a rally. Talking doesn't bring porridge into the pot.
Of course, President Mugabe has blamed Western nations for the economic problems in Zimbabwe, particularly the sanctions, he says.
That's what all dictators do. They seem to find somebody to blame for their mistakes. They didn't ask him to violate human rights people so that the community would move away from him and the economy is destroyed. The land distribution program was a mess. It was horrible. There were so many debts. There was everything went wrong. People have 7 farms. There is no audit that has been carried on to give confidence to the international community. You can't blame them for your mistakes. That's wrong.
That's human rights activist Clement Moyo speaking with me from the Zimbabwe capital, Harare. Mining is big business in South Africa. It is the world's largest producer of chrome and platinum and the second largest producer of palladium and zirconium. It is also the fifth largest producer of gold. But digging up those riches is a dirty business, and it has left behind a poisonous legacy. Viewer's Kevin Enoch's report.
The informal township of Tudor Shaft is near Johannesburg, and even nearer to a number of old gold and heavy metal mines. It is surrounded by mounds of mine tailings that blow contaminated and radioactive dust through town. The water supply is filled with acidic leftover mine wastewater. Residents and environmental activists say living here is a death sentence.
My mother is dead because of this place. She died in 2007. She was diagnosed with TB also. Then they told me that the dust is inside her lungs. Then she passed away.
Some also grew their vegetables on contaminated soil. There is radon exposure. There is both the inhalation and the ingestion of radioactive dust.
A number of international studies have placed the blame squarely on the South African government, saying it hasn't done enough to clean up the mess or warn residents of the danger. But regulators say that is going to change.
I do realize that there has some time has elapsed. However, in our planning for this year, we have prioritized the cleanup operations to oversee the cleanup operations for the next 2 to 3 years.
The government has also launched a relocation project to get people out of the contaminated area, but critics say it's moving much too slowly. The problem is made worse by the fact that commodity prices are down across the board, and mining companies say they don't have the money to help clean up the mess. Kevin Enix, VOA News, Washington.
Briefly, before we leave you a summary of Africa news, the Ugandan military began withdrawing Wednesday from Central African Republic, saying it has defeated the lowest resistance army rebels. And that's it for this Thursday, April 20th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with our engineer Jimmy Cook, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing everyone in Africa a very good day.
Next on Let's Talk, interior design. What does it take to be one? Is it for a specific gender only? Well, join me next Monday on Let's Talk, and we'll discuss this, of course, in our usual light-hearted manner. So please, stay tuned.